Grassi, your host of the Rare Disease Report podcast. In the U.S., a rare disease is classified as having fewer than 200,000 documented cases per year. Less than 10% of them have an FDA-approved treatment. Dr. Mikkel Sekeres is a clinical scientist and essayist, chief of division of hematology in the Sylvester Cancer Center at Miami University, and chair of the medical advisory board of the Aplastic Anemia and MDS International Foundation. He's also chair of the American Society of Hematology. He's treated many patients, and in this episode shares insight on his experience treating patients with some extremely rare conditions, like those living with myelodysplastic syndromes, and even those which have progressed to acute myeloid leukemia. In our conversation, Dr. Sekeres does an excellent job of explaining how a patient's bone marrow is impacted by these conditions, so I'll leave that to the expert.
I'm Mikkel Sekeres. I'm chief of the Division of Hematology at the Sylvester Cancer Center at University of Miami, and I chair the Medical Advisory Board for the Aplastic Anemia and MDS International Foundation. I specialize in the treatment of people who have bone marrow disorders, specifically people who have different types of leukemias and myelodysplastic syndromes. And let me give a little background to that. Myelodysplastic syndromes, which we abbreviate MDS because it's so hard to say myelodysplastic syndromes, even for us, is a type of cancer of the bone marrow that's extremely variable in its prognosis. Some of my patients have a very mild form of it, and I had one patient once refer to it as mild displeasure syndrome because it really didn't impact his life very much. And then other people can have a much more severe form, which is much closer to an acute myeloid leukemia.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Now, so you do encounter some of these more rare diseases in your practice and your treatment of patients. I was just wondering if you could speak to the significance in observing Rare Disease Day.
Absolutely. So what is a rare disease? Let's start with that. The NIH defines a rare disease as something that affects fewer than 200,000 people in the United States each year. And the FDA actually uses a similar definition in identifying an orphan drug for an indication. Now, to me, 200,000 people sounds like a lot, because the diseases that I treat affect about 20,000 people per year in the United States. So MDS, as I talked about already, affects about 20,000 people in the United States. Acute myeloid leukemia is very similar to that, again, about 20,000. And we talk about these in terms of an incidence rate. What's the rate of people who are affected per 100,000 U.S. citizens per year? So MDS and acute myeloid leukemia, the rate of affecting people is about 5 per 100,000 people per year. I also take care of some bone marrow failure conditions, such as aplastic anemia, where the bone marrow is completely wiped out. It's like a vast wasteland. That affects about 1 per million people in the United States per year. The same is true of another condition called paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobinuria. Terribly descriptive name for what happens. People will get blood in their urine when they have this condition because the red blood cells in the bloodstream, lice, they kind of break apart and some of those contents go into the urine. That also affects about 1 per million people per year. So there's quote unquote rare diseases, and then there are very rare diseases that we care for in hematology.
Absolutely. And in terms of rare diseases, they really do go across the spectrum in terms of how prevalent they are. But I think it's true kind of across the board that awareness and advocacy is really a key component in treating these diseases.
Right. Well, you may have read about these academic-private partnerships that we've developed. And I think our relationship to the Aplastic Anemia and MDS Foundation is absolutely emblematic of it. I've long believed that as people who are researchers and academics, our research needs to start with our interactions with our patients and the information our patients are getting. So I became involved with the Aplastic Anemia and MDS Foundation probably about 20 years ago. And one of the reasons I was drawn to it is because I thought that was the very first stop a lot of patients have where they get educated about these rare diseases. And Aplastic Anemia and MDS Foundation has a variety of things that patients can turn to, everything from patient education materials and toolkits to conferences and webinars that they can participate in, or support groups.
Mm-hmm. And I know that the aim to increase awareness extends beyond just patients, and the main target audience is often clinicians as well. So I was wondering if you had any recommendation for healthcare professionals who encounter these diseases that you treat, like MDS, AML, or PNH, that, you know, they might not be familiar with them on first encounter. Do you have any recommendations for the best way to move forward or identify them?
Sure. I'll be honest with you. When I was in medical school, I didn't go through my rotations dreaming of one day taking care of people with myelodysplastic syndromes or paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobinuria. And the reason is that I just simply hadn't heard of it before. Maybe I encountered one patient with one of these diagnoses while I was in medical school, maybe a handful, maybe not even that many when I was in residency. So these are rare diseases. There are those of us who are self-described MDS nerds or aplastic anemia nerds who read everything that's out there on them and have dedicated our lives to taking care of this very niche specialty. And, you know, I take great joy in trying to know everything there is to know about these rare diseases so that I can serve my patients the best way. But listen, my hat's off to someone who's a general practitioner or somebody who practices general hematology and oncology. I'm not up on the latest treatments of breast cancer, lung cancer, colon cancer like these people are, because this is their bread and butter. These are the patients they see multiple times a day, every single day of their practice. And then maybe once every 6 months, they'll see somebody who has MDS or aplastic anemia. If those are the cases, and these patients present similarly, they tend to be older. They tend to have evidence of bone marrow failure where their blood counts are very, very low. They have a bone marrow biopsy where maybe even a pathologist isn't used to reading it and interpreting it. And we've done studies through the NHLBI where we've looked at local diagnoses of people who had suspected myelodysplastic syndromes, and then centrally reviewed diagnoses by two expert pathologists, and we found that there are discrepancies almost 30% of the time in what they're diagnosing. So my advice in those situations, and believe me, it's not any out of any inflated sense of self-worth, but it's because these are rare diagnoses, so get these folks to a specialist, and equally importantly, get them to a specialist pathologist who knows what they're looking at to make sure that this is the real diagnosis.
Absolutely. And then as in terms of patients, what kind of resources do they have specifically through an organization like AAMDS?
No, it's a great question. So AAMDS, Aplastic Anemia and MDS International Foundation specializes in people who have a rare bone marrow diagnosis. So if this were affecting me or a family member, my very first step would be to turn to a group like AAMDS where they already have patient education materials. And I've helped write some of these materials, as have my colleagues. So they're actually vetted through people who are disease experts in these rare diseases. Where they can get referred to someone who's an expert in this, who's close to their area. So it's hard. If you have a new diagnosis, you don't know whom to turn to. You have a lot of marketing materials that saturate the airwaves, but you don't know if that's truth and if that's the best person for your rare disease diagnosis. So a place like AAMDS can refer you to those groups. They also have educational opportunities, and those can be either through print materials, and these days, attending webinars virtually, and they have a library of these webinars that are in stock. So you can look up a presentation by a world expert in your diagnosis and see what they have to say about it and what their advice is to you. These sorts of organizations can also help with identifying clinical trials because, again, with rare diseases, we often don't have a lot of therapies we can offer somebody. So participating in new trials, I mean, I'm always thrilled when my patients have participated in a clinical trial of a drug that eventually gets approved by the FDA, but my patients could get it years earlier. And finally, somebody who has a rare diagnosis like paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobinuria has an opportunity to participate in a patient registry where they enter information about themselves. So as a collective, as a patient-initiated collective, they can help with the research that in the future is going to help them treat their disease.
That's excellent. And that actually leads me into my next question. I did read you wrote an article for The Hill discussing the effect that the COVID-19 pandemic has had on clinical trials for a lot of cancer patients. You said that due to a combination of procedural difficulties, staffing shortages, patient hesitancy, that there were many institutions that have had to reduce or even halt the amount of trials that they were performing. What kind of effect have you seen the pandemic have on these clinical trials, specifically in the rare disease space?
Yeah, that's a great question. So let's go back in time a little bit to the beginning of 2020 when this pandemic was just hitting. And we were trying to figure out what we needed to do on behalf of our patients in real time. And people sometimes forget that when you come and see me with a diagnosis of myelodysplastic syndromes and I give advice on how to treat you, I'm basing it on very well-designed studies that took years to accomplish. When we were pivoting to deal with the COVID pandemic, we didn't have years of well-designed studies to rely on. We were trying to manage this in real time before the studies had matured that now are guiding us in our recommendations about COVID. So at the very beginning in 2020, a lot of clinical trials shut down entirely. And they did not at the initiation of patients, not even at a lot of NCI-designated cancer centers like Sylvester, University of Miami. It was at the initiation of pharmaceutical companies because they were concerned that patients who have diagnoses that affect the immune system, like leukemia and myelodysplastic syndromes, those patients would be very susceptible to bad outcomes if they got a COVID infection as well, and they didn't want to see these patients dying on their clinical trials. To avoid that, they shut them down entirely. So at the institution where I was previously, 25% of clinical trials for people who had MDS or leukemia were shut down by the sponsor, not by the institution. Now, a lot of these have since opened again. There also was some hesitancy, as you alluded to, on behalf of patients, because one of the benefits of participating in a clinical trial is you're under very strict supervision by your healthcare provider for your treatment and any side effects of your treatment. And sometimes that includes extra visits to the healthcare setting. Well, patients were afraid of going to healthcare settings, particularly during the first wave of COVID. So a lot of patients avoided participating in clinical trials. We've gotten through that. Our clinical trials opened in force more during 2021 than during 2020, but then you had subsequent waves hit. And what we've seen is with every wave, enrollment to clinical trials has gone down. More recently, what we've seen, and this is a consequence of what you've probably read in the newspapers or heard on podcasts, is the Great Resignation. Just as you've heard about people around the country resigning from their jobs and, you know, rethinking what their values are, that has happened in spades in clinical research for cancer studies, where research coordinators, the people who have to ensure the sanctity of the trial and that it's being conducted safely, have left. And as those people have left, a lot of cancer centers have had to decide about delaying opening of new trials, closing trials entirely once again, or kind of sputtering along and opening up some trials but not other trials, given the staff who are available to actually monitor these studies. So my concern is that it takes about, from the very moment one of us comes up with an idea for a clinical trial and starts writing that clinical trial until the time that trial is published, it takes about 5 years. On average, it can take 5 to 8 years for a drug, once it's filed its initial investigational new drug application to the FDA, until it can actually file its new drug application where it actually wants to get FDA approved. Years. So if we're not enrolling patients to clinical trials now, 2020, 21, 22, we're not going to be seeing those new drugs appear 2025, 26, 27. So we continue, this continues to be an ongoing threat. My, you know, what I implore my patients, if they have the opportunity to participate in a clinical trial, particularly if they have a rare disease. They owe it to themselves to do so because we don't have a lot of drugs available to treat them. And they owe it, in all honesty, to future patients who have these diagnoses.
Absolutely. Now, I think you did mention in your article that you recently designed a clinical trial yourself. And I was wondering if you could speak about that and what kind of population you were aiming it towards and what that process is like, especially now with all the obstacles that you're talking about.
Yeah, thanks for asking. So I have dedicated a good portion of my career to exploring combinations of drugs to treat people who have myelodysplastic syndromes. And in general, we divide people who have MDS into two major groups: those who have lower risk MDS, and that includes that mild dysplasia syndrome that I mentioned earlier, and people who have higher risk MDS, where it's much closer to acute myeloid leukemia. The trial I alluded to in that article was designed for people who have lower risk MDS, and it actually combines two drugs that are already approved by the FDA for the treatment of MDS, but they haven't been looked at together before. One of those drugs is luspatercept. The other drug is lenalidomide. And we're exploring these two drugs in people who have lower risk MDS who've already received one treatment for their lower risk MDS. So this is the population where we only have limited numbers of drugs available, and we're starting to run out of tools in our toolkit. So we're trying to see if we can offer something that has a better chance of working. This trial is open here at University of Miami, and we're opening it at 5 other centers around the country. All of these centers are NCI, National Cancer Institute, Comprehensive Cancer Center. So these are major players in cancer, and people with experienced investigators who see a lot of patients with rare diseases. And we've approached other centers, they are also experiencing similar types of delays that we've seen in opening trials because of a lack of research personnel. So we're hoping that as Omicron is receding, we're going to be able to move clinical trials forward quicker and get them open for the people who really need them.
What do you believe needs to happen in order to get these clinical trials moving at a productive pace again?
Yeah, another great question. So there are some relatively straightforward things that we can do to make clinical trials more successful and impervious to future pandemics or pandemic surges. First, we can design them so that they largely mirror what would be done in a standard of care setting anyway. Sometimes clinical trials add on a lot of additional testing or visits that may be necessary for certain trial endpoints, but aren't necessary for a patient's care. So we can limit the number of those extra visits or even eliminate the extra visits entirely so a patient doesn't have hesitancy in participating in a clinical trial because they're going to have contact with the healthcare system that they would have anyway. Secondly, we can start to incorporate more and more telemedicine into how we conduct clinical trials. When I first talk to a patient about a clinical trial, I go through a very formal, informed consent discussion so that patients understand the risks of therapy, the potential benefits of it, alternative treatment options that they have, and the people who are helping them as they enter a clinical trial. Well, that sort of discussion, for example, can happen on a Zoom call like we're having right now, or certain check-in visits. Gee, are you having any side effects to the pills? How are you feeling? That doesn't have to be person to person. That can also be by telemedicine. So minimizing contact with healthcare facilities. Another way we can do this is by shipping medications, particularly pills, directly to a patient's house instead of requiring that that person show up at a pharmacy. Right? Then we're eliminating yet another contact with the healthcare profession, particularly if this is a prescription that needs to be picked up monthly. Finally, there are some harder things that we can do, and that has to do with regulatory requirements by the FDA in monitoring trials to try to streamline them and, again, make them much more easily doable, regardless of whether a pandemic is hitting.
Right. And I'm assuming that that's become more and more clear in the last few years, just the areas that could be potentially condensed or switched to telemedicine, things like that.
Right, right. And you know, if you're going to pull, there are a couple of silver linings I guess I can pull out of the pandemic. One is I've seen a lot more focus on family among my patients, a lot more time they're spending with family. My own personal anecdote is I have kids who in the past were very quick to find an excuse to rush through dinner and run off and be with their friends. When they can't see their friends as often, they actually linger and have a real conversation around the dinner table, right? And we've got to pivot a little bit in how we're focusing on the good things that are coming out of this instead of what a wretched experience it's been for the past 2 years. Mm-hmm. Another good thing that's come out of this is we've realized how much we can do remotely. And that also goes for the research coordinators who have to be present to monitor a trial and make sure it happens successfully. These folks don't have to be in a workplace environment where they could potentially spread infection. A lot of these folks want to work from home. They want to avoid the commute in a city like Miami. So allowing them to work from home and showing that it can be effective has actually come out of this as well.
Well, thank you so much for all your insight. Is there anything that you wanted to mention that we haven't covered?
I think the last thing I would leave you with, I want to leave us with a thought that's focused more on patients. And that is the importance of a person with a new diagnosis of a rare disease to become knowledgeable about that disease as soon as possible and as completely as possible. It is true, knowledge is power, not only from yourself, but from members of your family who may be advocates for you in the future. So I urge them to turn to places like Aplastic Anemia and MDS Foundation, which is a trusted source as opposed to broad searches on the internet, which I don't oppose. I love when patients come and ask me questions from the internet so we can address misconceptions, but the internet is an unrefereed environment and you want to go to a place where the knowledge that you're trying to gain has actually been closely vetted and curated.
Thank you, Dr. Mikkel Sekeres, for joining us on this month's episode. Next month, we'll be back with another expert to discuss a different rare disease. Be sure to subscribe on Spotify, iTunes, or your favorite podcast platform so you don't miss our monthly episodes. In the meantime, check out our daily coverage on rare disease and medical news at our website, hcplive.com. And follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn. I'm your host, Juliana Grassi. Thank you for joining me for another episode of The Rare Disease Report.